You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm joined by my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge. Hi, Guy.
Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm good. I've been looking at one of those websites, and it's an American website, and on it...
What are you... I'm always worried what you're going to say when you start
And on it,
about
it's got
like
all
that.
The different national days, national food days. So I was looking down, I was thinking, oh, do you know what? Shall I have a look at what day it is today for our, food talk recording? Mm-hmm. And it's National White Chocolate Day.
That is an excellent day to have chosen to be here in
the
studio.
On my way here, on the way to studio, bearing in mind that we're in London, I stopped off and I've got you four different types of white chocolate to taste.
Oh, so kind. Thank you. Just for me.
Well, and our lovely guests who I'll introduce in a minute.
Okay.
And the reason why I did that is I really don't like white chocolate. Because it just reminds me of, those Cadbury's white buttons you had when you were a kid? And
well, like the Milky Bar button-y
they're
things.
So sugary. And I never have white chocolate ever. And I thought, do you know what? I need to try some proper quality stuff on
and
National.
It looks really, really nice.
Yeah, we've National White Chocolate Day. So I thought, should we have a little tasting today? And I was going to try and... We haven't got any white chocolate makers here, I have to say. But because it's White Chocolate Day, I thought we'll have a go. And I thought we'd have a taste.
So I think secretly, because our two lovely guests, who are lovely, but didn't bring anything for us to eat or drink, you were like, oh, crap, we better go and get some stuff to eat and drink.
No. Well, yeah, I did actually. I just thought these national days, I don't know if they actually work as a marketing tool, but it's quite interesting. So we are joined by Sian Sutherland from A Plastic Planet. Hi, Sian.
Hi there.
Are you okay tasting a little bit of white chocolate? Or is that against
just
your...
Just thinking how lucky we came on the right day.
Yeah, you did come on the right day.
Well, sometimes
also,
we get gin and wine and stuff like that.
Okay, so, we came on the wrong day.
But
the chocolate is good, though.
The good thing about chocolate, no plastic here, no plastic packaging here.
Yeah.
So I thought it would be in your good books there.
I did notice you unwrap one and it looked really super nice and earthy on the outside, craft paper, inside, clear plastic. Did you notice that?
Which one was
you
that?
You ditched it.
Am I going to get
it
told
off? It's a square
one. It's a square one, okay.
Oh, the fancy one.
Yes, sorry about that. And also we've got Adam Beveridge from Hollerbox. Hi, Adam.
Hi there.
Yeah, are you okay tasting a bit of chocolate
this afternoon?
I'd love
to taste some chocolate, I really would.
Great, okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about chocolate. I actually know quite a bit about chocolate.
Excellent, because I don't know anything other than eating it.
I don't really like eating it much, unless it's particularly sort of darkish.
That's one of the only things I know about chocolate, actually, is that you don't like it very much.
Yeah. So I'm just going to give you a little rundown before we have a taste. So I think we all know that there's three types of chocolate, isn't there? Sort of dark chocolate, milk chocolate, and white chocolate. And most people have their favourite. Mm-hmm. But actually, white chocolate isn't actually chocolate.
Yeah, because it's got no cocoa solids in it, has it?
No. So it's not actually real chocolate because it doesn't contain any cocoa solids. And it's primarily made out of cocoa butter, sugar, milk solids, and white chocolate must contain at least 14% milk solids in order for it to be called white chocolate. And there are quite a lot of sugar and sweetener, much more sugar and sweeteners than there are in
to give it some flavour.
Yeah, which is why I think I don't like it so much. So although it's technically not real chocolate, it's mostly got cocoa butter in and sugar, milk, and milk solids, which gives it that sort of slightly fatty smoothie, which is what some people really like about it. So it has a much higher proportion of cocoa butter. If you get good white chocolate, it should have real vanilla.
Yes.
You see that thing that says vanillin. Shouldn't ever have
vanillin.
Anything.
Vanillin. Oh, this is the synthetic stuff, isn't it?
It's an artificial vanilla flavouring. Yeah. And should never, it doesn't taste very nice at all. And as far as I'm concerned, shouldn't really have that at all.
Not in the quality stuff that you've got.
So it should be high in... cocoa butter, and cocoa butter is when you roast the sort of cocoa beans, they're sort of ground into a paste, and you get this chocolate liquor that comes out, and that's then put through a sort of press, and you get sort of it separates into sort of cocoa mass, and then the cocoa butter.
Ah, okay.
And it's the cocoa butter that it's the thing that you know. So it's laughed
like
after left
like
after
the
it's
fat
pressed.
That rises to the top,
yeah,
almost.
Absolutely. Now, top tips for buying white chocolate. If you're out there and you're listening and you think, well, I actually like white chocolate, Nelson, so, get lost. If you are going to get some great white chocolate, this is what you should look at. You should never go for anything that's pure white. because it's been bleached, and you know, the ingredients have been bleached, and not a good sign, frankly.
In terms of the colour, you mean it shouldn't be pure white?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And since cocoa butter is ivory coloured, you know, you will see that proper good white chocolate should be that off-white colour as well. So have a look at that. If it's white in colour, it means that they've used, you know, artificial colourings, also probably vegetable oil or some other fat rather than cocoa butter. Don't eat that rubbish. And due to the higher sort of fat and sugar content, actually white chocolate melts very well. So it can be quite good to cook with.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in essence, white chocolate doesn't have the two key ingredients. It doesn't have chocolate liquor and it doesn't have cocoa solid, which is why some people say that it's, you know, it's not real chocolate. But I'm going to try and convince myself that we should try something different.
I've got four different brands.
Yeah, I just nipped out and I thought I'll try that. So I bought, the first one I bought is Green and Blacks.
Friends of the show.
Obvious. Yeah, they've been on the show. So I'm going to just dish those out.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And obviously these are it's not fair really to compare when the prices are so different.
Mm.
So this is the cheapest of the bunch.
Oh, right. And some people would say that Green and Blacks is like a premium chocolate.
Yeah, the cheapest, because I've gone up market here.
Where did you go?
Right. So I've been down to Planet Organic and a Whole Foods market to see what they had.
Very nice.
So this is the first one. Adam, you've just tucked straight in there, haven't you? You haven't even asked.
I am holding it, waiting.
You didn't get brought up properly by your mum, did you? Right, go straight in there. So they've got 30% cocoa and it's Madagascan vanilla, they say that they've got. I can't talk and eat, so you're going to have to take over now.
Unfortunately,
so
I've just started eating
it. Oh, okay.
I'm just putting it on, really. It's nice. It's nice and smooth. I buy this myself for cooking with primarily.
I think that's absolutely disgusting.
Really?
Oh, no.
It is a sweet chocolate. It is quite sweet, but I like that kind of blend of the vanilla as something to cut through that sugary sweetness.
I'm with Sue. That is really sickly.
Mm. It's really sickly.
But I just don't like white chocolate. So if you love white chocolate, probably this is amazing.
Sure. That would be amazing, but it's definitely not to my taste.
I look forward to being converted to something of higher quality.
Well, I hope so. It
might
not be here.
We'll see how we go.
Adam, you said you love chocolate.
Well, I went through this phase of telling everyone I really liked white chocolate. Mm. And then, as you do, Christmas, birthdays, that's all I get. That's all I got bought was white chocolate.
Right. Well, we never know too much of it.
We never know what to buy, boys. You see, that's the trouble.
Yeah, so it is nice, but I guess I'm a bit like, oh, no, it all tastes the same. This has a different texture. I think it sort of melts on the tongue a bit more and you can feel it a bit more powdery. It does taste nice, though, in my opinion. I know you guys have said all...
I wouldn't say that we're experts, but we do like it, don't we?
But I think Sian's with me, and I don't know if I've found as I've got older, I like sugary things less. I don't know if you do, but
and that whole thing of if it is going to be super sweet, have something to balance it out, which is when that salt thing works so well, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so now I've got Cocoa Chocolatier, and they're based in Edinburgh, established in 2004. They make chocolate by hand, and this one is white chocolate, and it's raspberry and vanilla bean.
It looks it's got some red flecks in it as well, with the raspberry
in there. Yeah.
Good combination, white chocolate and raspberry. Classic.
I'm staying good to form and I just dive straight in. I like that one.
The raspberry is very subtle. It doesn't really come through a huge amount.
Now,
just at the end. Not as sweet, though, as the Green and Blacks.
It isn't as sweet, is it? Doesn't seem to have much taste to me.
No.
Are you getting any taste either?
No. That one's pretty bland to me. I definitely can't taste any fruit in there.
No. Very, very, like too subtle, almost.
What you definitely won't. I can tell you've got a sweet tooth, Adam. So I'm thinking that you might
just like food in general. I still prefer the first one. As you said, it was a bit.
I don't know whether it tastes bland because the other one was so.
It might be incredibly sweet. It's overpowered.
So I would say that's white chocolate for people who don't like white chocolate because it doesn't taste like white chocolate. So, yes.
We're giving this white chocolate day a real hard time today, aren't we?
Really doing very well. Okay, so this one, Vivani, and I've never seen these before. I got this in Planet Organic, and they're German. Didn't know German made chocolate.
Belgium chocolate is the one that I would say is the classic.
So I'm just going to give you this.
Isn't
European chocolate made in a slightly different way as well?
I think it might be. This has got a little bit of mango in it and white coconut.
It smells very mango-y. Have you had a sniff?
Yeah.
Oh, blimey, that does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Very, very fruity.
We need our friend Paul A. Young back on the show to tell us all about all this stuff.
He would tell us about white chocolate. Well, he probably hasn't used white chocolate, has he?
Not sure, actually. Oh, yeah, that's quite nice.
That is lovely. For me, if I have fruit, it's going to be like strawberries or raspberries. Having mango feels a bit different, but it does. It almost doesn't taste chocolatey, does it?
Yeah, I think that's why I like it, because I can taste so much mango, I'm not really tasting white chocolate.
And there's some little bits of coconut in there as well, so it's got a little bit of texture to it.
That doesn't do it for me either. So it was just because kind of it doesn't taste
thrown
like
it onto the table in front of
what
us.
What I was hoping today, as somebody who doesn't eat white chocolate, is that I'd have an epiphany and go, oh, so that is what white chocolate tastes like if it's done properly. I can't really taste anything. Maybe that's why they put the mango in it, because it needs something.
Mm. It's almost a different thing altogether.
If you're not going to hit
it needs
it with
another
loads of
name,
sugar.
Not chocolate.
I couldn't eat more than a couple of pieces of that last one, because it was very, very strong in the flavour of the mango and the coconut.
Yeah.
This last one, though, looks like plain white chocolate.
Yeah, so let me tell you about some. See, I'm a great fan of, I don't know how you pronounce it, I think it's called Akersons. Is that how you pronounce it?
It's a Scandinavian brand, is it?
This one smells the best. Definitely.
This actually smells chocolatey, not white chocolatey.
So they own their own plantation in Madagascar. So they actually are bean to bar. So they actually do own their own. They have great taste awards all the time for their chocolate. This is the first time they've made white chocolate, which I think is an interesting development. So in 2015 they started making white chocolate. They've actually got a great taste award for this, which I can't believe. So, because it's white.
Well, you haven't tasted it.
No, I haven't tasted it yet. And it's a single plantation. It's the only single plantation white chocolate that you can get. So this is my last chance of really getting to like white chocolate.
You
so
might actually like this.
I don't think you'd be disappointed. To me, that tastes like normal milk chocolate.
It does, yeah. It's got a...
Just a little bit sweeter.
You have to say something while I'm eating, Guy. Sorry.
We're waiting intently for your verdict.
We need to hear the verdict. But no, I think that's really interesting. It tastes, it's got that cocoa flavour that you get from real dark chocolate.
Oh, it's got a nice aftertaste.
And it's very, very smooth.
It's quite complicated, actually.
Mm, it is. Mm. I assume this is the premium end of the premium scale that we're looking
at
here.
I'm afraid to say that this is £5.50 something a bar. So it's incredibly expensive. So it's not fair to judge them against the others, when it's so expensive.
And I'm trying to see the weight of this bar.
It's not the biggest bar in the world either, by the looks of it, is it?
No, it's tiny.
Would you buy this, Sean?
Honestly, if I had a choice of that and a really good dark with some sea salt or caramel, it's the dark every time.
It's the dark, yeah. Mm.
So this is a 60-gram bar at £5 something. So that's pretty pricey, but very good.
I think because of the average supermarket sort of spending, you've got your Dairy Milks, your Galaxies in the way all the time, and they're so much cheaper. For me personally, I think I'd always just go there because I know what I'm getting. It's safe and I like it and it's affordable.
I'm thinking of these though, Adam, more like for after dinner, you know, when somebody's got a really nice meal and all that, and it's a treat. Mm. I mean, you wouldn't buy this, well, not if you're really rich, I guess, not if you're Victoria Beckham,
just,
but I don't think Victoria Beckham eats chocolate.
4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, this is a real premium sort of end, I think. And I think I would get this if I knew somebody liked white chocolate
as a real treat.
I wouldn't buy it myself, I don't think.
No, it's probably got a lot less sugar in it though, hasn't it?
Than the others, yes, absolutely. Well, that's white chocolate day. It's not, that didn't go off with a...
I can't wait for dark chocolate day.
Well, it gave us something to talk about.
Apparently there's a chocolate week, apparently. So that's when you need to go for it, Sean. Yeah. So I'm moving on from white chocolate day. Good luck with anybody else if they want to nip out and support white chocolate day and get some white chocolate. Definitely
any
go
excuse,
for the
really, isn't it?
Akersons or if not, I'd... personally just go back to the Cadbury's white chocolate drops, might as well. So Sean, let's talk a little bit about you. You initially founded Miller Sutherland, and that was a sort of brand creation and design agency in 1991. So you've got a real sort of background in sort of brands and, you know, sort of understanding how people buy things and all that sort of stuff. And then got quite involved in skincare. But then you've got a real thing about plastic. Now, I'm embarrassed here because we're sitting in the radio studio and we've got four bottles of water that are in plastic bottles. So you're probably really ashamed of us.
I was coming in, guys.
Yeah,
come on,
know,
make an effort.
Well, we've got you some
chocolate.
Don't
make it so easy for me.
I've got some chocolate. I was hoping that might help. Tell me why you feel so passionate about plastic and what you've set up.
Well, as you say, I've had quite a varied career and I've done lots of different things, including restaurants and film production, brand creation, and then created and ran a skincare brand for 10 years. So you will imagine I am personally responsible for bringing a lot of plastic into the world.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. I didn't really know what had happened to that plastic. It didn't occur to me to even think about it. I just knew it was an incredible material and very easy to use for packaging and everything else. And then 2 years ago, I got involved in the launch of the film A Plastic Ocean. I don't know if any of you have seen that, but highly recommended. And to be honest, really life-changing. Because when you see that film and you realise what we've done, and that's, you know, we in a super collective way, because this is nothing that we're talking about today is about guilt or blame. We're all responsible for this.
Yeah.
And then you see this film and you realise what we've done. Not only to the oceans, but now, you know, how we are potentially impacting our own health. And then you leave that film or you see whatever is happening on, you know, Sky with their ocean rescue campaign. And this year, more than ever, there's a huge amount of coverage on the whole issue of plastic. Mm. And you leave there and you think, OK, I'm going to change. I want to decrease my plastic footprint. I understand now. Now I know, I can't unknow. You go to the supermarket to do your weekly grocery shopping. It's impossible
it's
to change.
Everywhere.
It's everywhere. And this is from Whole Foods to Lidl. Every single supermarket is a sea of plastic. So my friend Frederica Magnusson and I decided this is really like a fundamental human right that's been taken away from us. Right now you can buy dairy-free and gluten-free and fat-free and all of these things. But you go to your supermarket and you try and buy plastic-free and it's virtually impossible. Mm. So we decided that we would create like a collective, really, of creative activism, which is called A Plastic Planet. And our first campaign is asking supermarkets to give us a plastic-free aisle. So an aisle that you can push a trolley down and guilt-free, worry-free, you can fill that trolley with everything that you need, your meat, your fish, your fruit and your veg, dairy, pasta, sauces, snacks, chocolate, everything that you need for your weekly shop without plastic.
Which and is plastic, a tall order, isn't it? Because it's everywhere in all sorts of different shapes and sizes
really
and formats.
Thought about it in that way before, is that you don't have the choice. I mean, I'm lucky enough now, you know, now the children left home and all that sort of thing, then I'm much freer and have more time to spend shopping as opposed to trying to juggle 500 million things a day. So I tend to buy much more food in farmers markets and things like that. And of course, there isn't a sea of plastic because you're buying, you know, direct. But of course, when you do go into a supermarket, you don't really have much choice at all, do you?
And I guess it comes in so many different forms. Like we're looking at some plastic bottles with water in them in front of us here, and that's a very obvious, this is a plastic thing. But I guess even like the cling film type of thing that you would get wrapping a piece of meat or something like that is a form of plastic.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the most dangerous forms of plastic.
Yeah.
Because the thing that we're finding out more and more now, the kind of big white elephant in the room that nobody really wants to talk about, is the effect on our health. Mm-hmm. And when you have moist, fatty meat and fish, those kind of products, or cheese, and you have those wrapped in plastic, then the potential for phthalates, for chemicals to leach into the food is very high.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah, and that does affect our health. And I think there's increasing science about this now.
As it's white chocolate day, it's a white chocolate elephant that's in the room. It's not just a white elephant.
Very good.
So if I've got this bottle of water in front of me and then I'm going to put it in the bin here, it will get recycled. Is that not good enough? Is that what you're saying?
You think it'll get recycled?
I hope so.
And if only it were that simple that you can just throw it away and it's somebody else's responsibility. But the reality is, in the UK particularly, we're very bad at recycling. So if that bottle is, it's got a 7% chance of being recycled.
Wow. So if somebody comes, I've got these bins. You know, I've got three bins, I think, outside my house. You know, one of them is for plastic and glass, which I presume they separate when they get down to the wherever it is. Are you saying that why am I bothering, you know, putting the plastic bottles in there because actually they're not going to get reused?
All I'm saying is, you know, everyone wants to do their bit,
yes.
And of course you want to do the right thing.
Mm.
But the reality is that if somebody has then put in a dirty yogurt pot or an unwashed pasta sauce jar, then that entire bin load is going to be rejected and it's going to go to landfill.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's why the percentage of recycling is so small in this country. And there's no centralised policy for it. So every borough, just in London, every borough has a different approach. And it doesn't behove the councils to do more with the waste because the value isn't there anymore. So everybody talks about recycling. And it's a bit of a red herring, really, to talk about recycling, because, yes, of course, that needs to get better. But that's a seismic change that is going to take years. See, so what we're talking about is turn the tap off a little bit of use.
Don't buy it. Yeah,
just let's use less of it. And particularly in single-use applications like food packaging, where it's the average length of time that single-use plastic is actually useful is 11 minutes. And then it exists on our planet forever. Yeah. And we've already got 9 billion tons of it on the planet.
Wow. I do have a problem with recycling in the amount of water it uses. So you get a yogurt pot. You think, right, I'll do the right thing. I'll wash it all before I stick it. Well, you're using loads and loads of water in order to do that and loads and loads of energy. And you know, so it's a very complicated. You know, recycling is a very, very complicated thing, isn't it, in terms of, you know, whether it's of benefit, environmental benefit to recycle some things and not others and make them into other things. It's incredibly complicated.
It is. And there are alternatives. Mm. But it takes a big shift in supermarket bosses' minds, really, to think, okay, finding alternatives versus let's just perpetuate how we're using plastic right now. And at the moment, everybody talks about recycling. Yeah, we need a circular economy. Yes, we do. We need different kinds of plastic. Yes, we do. But actually, the easiest thing that we can make a difference today is use less plastic in the first place, particularly on food.
But that is going to take another huge seismic change from the institutions that really don't have a huge amount to gain themselves from making such a big change.
Or do they?
Because they should see it that way. But
they should. And I know, you know, if we were saying this is all about our health and it's all about the health of the planet, that's one thing. And yes, supermarkets are giant Titanics, and they're taking baby steps, particularly in the UK, they're taking baby steps. But maybe there's another way of looking at it, which is right now, why do we go into a supermarket in the first place when we can go to your farmer's market? Or what a huge amount of people do is just go online, go into a virtual aisle that is curated for me because they know my choices, click, 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 gets delivered free in an hour. So what do supermarkets on the high street need to do in order to keep us going in there? And they all talk about what we need to do is create more theatre, create more animation.
An experience. A retail experience. Yeah.
So you think, so how can we do that? Why are we not creating aisles where you are not distanced from your food with layer and layer and layer of plastic, but actually we reconnect with our food? You know, and everything your programme is about is, you know, rekindling our relationship with food. And this could be an opportunity to do that in supermarket aisles, to take the plastic away, have alternatives, reconnect us to the food, create an aisle that is not like the hippy-dippy weirdo aisle that nobody wants to go down. You know, only people with knitted armpits and hairy sandals want to go down. This could be the aisle that actually it looks lush and gastronomic and delicious and what food should look like. So that's our vision.
I was going to ask, just jumping in, from a business perspective, how you think this kind of move, like with these big institutions, obviously thinking about their bottom line, like how you think it affects them financially? Because I used to work at GlaxoSmithKline, I used to do like planograms. I'd plan where items went on shelves and things. And obviously, you think you've got brands and these things all in the packaging and that. And how you think this kind of move would affect, you know, how they can make money, essentially. What they're going to package it up with, how's this packaging going to appeal to consumers, for example?
Yeah, how are they going to brand it?
Well, there's alternatives out there. So, you know, you can go back to paper, card. Does everything need to have a little plastic window in it? Glass. Yeah. You know, materials that people often talk about, oh, but does that increase your carbon footprint? Of course, that's a concern. But the reality is you can offset your carbon footprint. You can never offset your plastic footprint. It's there forever. So, you know, when you think about all those 9 billion tonnes, every bit of plastic that's ever been made still exists.
I mean,
it goes into landfill.
When you think how many...
Or into the oceans.
And into the oceans. And, you know, as we know, there's the now infamous Ellen MacArthur Foundation quote that by the year 2050, there will be more plastic by weight in the seas than fish. And that feels really tangible to me now. Hopefully I'm going to be alive in 2050. And this is the legacy that we're leaving for the next generation.
I was just adding that up and working whether I'll be alive or not. No, I don't think I will.
Not if you eat that white chocolate.
The other stat that we've got here in our research is 8 million tonnes of plastic are dumped into the oceans every day. which is a lot.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, eight million tons. And I mean, there are parts of the ocean where you've got the ratio of plankton to microplastics of 2 to 1. So, you know, we know it's in our food chain. We know now that if you are a seafood eater in the UK, every year you are ingesting up to 11,000 little pieces of plastic. And what we don't really know is how does that impact our own health?
Mm. There are some advances in this area, though,
in
terms
of... I'm feeling a bit depressed.
Well, it's a time for change.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
think, you know, this year, more than any other, most people that you talk to on the street, they now know about plastic. A year ago, nobody cared. And I feel that we're at a tipping point. So I feel really optimistic about it. But we're the ones that have to make the change. And it's going to be consumers making the change.
I think it is a very good time. Like, speaking from quite a young person's perspective, I think a lot of young people out there are caring a lot more about the planet, are caring a lot about their own health. I think it's a good time to kind of ease us into how we can make changes and aid these kind of causes as well.
And I do think the supermarkets have a huge amount of power, as we know. I don't think they often use it very wisely, and I think sometimes they use it to drive prices down and squeeze, you know, supplies in a way that I sometimes find unethical. They really could use their power in terms of plastic, couldn't they?
And that's
if they really decided to put their foot down.
Absolutely right. So that's why we're working with the supermarkets.
Yeah.
So yes, we're talking to people like Unilever, you know, who also have huge clout and are doing amazing things already. There's a lot of things in the pipeline, but the pace of change is so slow.
Yeah.
So that's why we decided we're going to take it into our own hands.
Yeah.
And we started by doing things like creating this online video wall that on our website, aplasticplanet.com, which is simply everybody. And it's interesting, you mentioning about the younger generation. You're absolutely right. The amount of young people who have posted videos onto our video wall asking for a plastic-free aisle. We did a big poll, nationwide poll, 91% of the British public said that they wanted a plastic-free aisle. So when we talk about the economics of it, it makes sense.
Yeah, completely.
That, you know, there is, we've proven that there is a demand for it. Change is going to happen. Legislation is going to happen. And how great for the supermarkets for once to look predictive, to look like, yeah, they understand that consumers need this. They understand that they're caring about their health. They're caring about the health of the planet. So do it before they're forced to do it.
And you're only asking for one aisle out of however many they have
as a
starting point.
Exactly. But what I think will be wonderful is that that aisle will be like this kind of pulsing, amazing nucleus of change that will permeate through the whole supermarket.
I mean, who would have thought even 3 or 4 years ago that every single supermarket now has a free from aisle, whatever they call it. I don't know what they call it now.
And how long did it take?
I don't know. Did that take very long?
Such a long time, yeah. And
now they're huge, though, because so many people are opting for that wanted it.
Either because they need to or because they want to.
Because they want to, yeah.
Yeah, really interesting.
Okay, well, I am feeling a bit depressed, so I'm going to have a little break. I might eat some chocolate to
pick yourself up.
pick myself up. So a little break, and then we're going to obviously come back and talk again to Sian and also to Adam. Just during the break, we're going to listen to Disco Soup interviews. Mm. This is really exciting. So have a listen to that, and then we'll join you later.
So, James, we're here at Mercato Neapolitano, and it's Disco Soup. What is Disco Soup?
Well, yeah, it's a crazy idea, isn't it? It's Mercato Metropolitano's first birthday, and they're looking to celebrate and shout about sustainability. So we're going to find out a bit more about that tonight, aren't we?
And it's local community coming together, producing food. I think Minister of Sound are in there doing some music, and it's going to be a fun evening doing some stuff, yeah?
Yeah, a lot of music, a lot of free food as well, so I'm more than happy.
Let's go. So Dominika Yaros is here from Feedback. Now, I was listening to you earlier and you talked about feeding the 5,000. Tell us a little bit about how that started and how that has now developed into this event.
Sure, so Feeding the 5,000 started all the way back in 2009, and it was an idea concocted by a chap called Tristram Stewart, who had just written a book on food waste and the scandal of the fact that over a third of the world's food is wasted. And he figured not many people would probably read his book, so he wanted to really show people, because at the time no one was really talking about the issue, and people thought, oh, food waste, supermarket bins. and he rescued all this food that would otherwise have gone to waste, fresh, delicious food, cooked it up in collaboration with chefs and served it for free to 5,000 people in the heart of London. And it was really a spectacle, and it just, it birthed the movement. And since then, we've organised or collaborated on over 40 Feeding the 5,000 events around the world. And they've also, so those are the big scale ones, the massive ones in the biggest spaces. We also collaborate a lot with local communities, and that's what brings us here today. We're organising London's biggest disco soup, which in itself is also a global movement where everyone comes together, chops together, cooks together and eats together.
Because isn't that part of the community? And I think, have we not lost a little bit of that, of actually coming together, cooking as I, you know, whether it's a group, a community or whatever, and enjoying it together?
Absolutely. It's really fun when you do it together, when you have some great DJs. We've got the Ministry of Sound DJs here.
I'm probably a bit too old to remember them, to be quite honest, but yeah.
Well, they're a legendary venue just two doors down, so they've come over here to DJ in their neighbour's backyard. We've got everyone's drinking toast ale, responsibly, of course.
I'm going to try some a little bit later on.
Be wasted and neither should you. Please drink toast responsibly is the tagline, as well as brewing a better
product. So tell me, I mean, that in itself is a great example of taking food waste, and you're right, you know, there's a third of all food produced goes to waste, and it's actually about maximising what we get out of our food products.
Absolutely, and you know, with bread it's even higher. It's about 40% of bread in the UK is wasted, and it's something that consumers or citizens don't even have control over, because the bread that we rescue and we use to make our beer isn't even stuff that people have the option of buying, because it's offcuts from the industrial sandwich business. So we make a delicious beer out of it and raise money for feedback in the process.
So what else? Obviously, feedback is about trying to get a message across to communities and to people, but also upwards as well. And what are the key messages you're trying to get across?
Absolutely. I'd say we're pretty much unique as an organisation in the sense that one day we are chopping up delicious vegetables at a place like Mercato, engaging with volunteers from all across London with the local communities. And the next day we are in meetings with the directors of Tesco, with like real industry players, challenging them, bringing them evidence from our research, from our investigations, and challenging them to do more within their supply chains, and that's on a global scale.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll do a little bit more later. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So Martin Lent from SCM Management is with me. Now Martin, you're developing very much a community building local to the Mercato, aren't you?
Yes, we're a few hundred yards away. It's a 40-storey tower that is going live in spring next year, and we're very committed to working with the community in the Mercato to help make sure that the area is really on the map for everybody.
So tell me a little bit about your development. So 40-storey tower, in terms of, is it mixed development or is it just residential?
It's a mixed development, private resi, affordable housing, and also got retail shops and offices. So it's a real mixed-use scheme, and it's going to be coming online in spring next year.
And you're supporting Mercato. Are you involved with them as well, yeah?
Well, we originally loved what they were doing so much that we sponsored the new community kitchen where school kids are coming in to learn how to prepare food, and we started by doing that. And then when the opportunity came along to help with this weekend, again, because it's such an important message that's coming across, we love being part of it, and 251 has been delighted to support it.
And 251 is your actual development, isn't it? That's what it's called.
Yeah, it's a 251 development that's been standing behind this.
I think, you know, to support community projects like this is a great way of returning something to community, and you know, I really think it's really important that local businesses do that, and I congratulate you on doing that, so well done.
Thank you. I mean, the whole thing is all working together. When everybody realises, from the local council to the community to the property side of things, everyone's working together and needs each other. And the more you can work together, the more successful it works.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, and best of luck with the last bit of the development.
Thank you very much.
So I'm joined by Angela Malik, and Angela sits on the London Food Board. Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So perhaps tell our listeners a little bit about the work of the London Food Board and what you've been doing recently.
So the London Food Board is appointed by each mayor. Every mayor has their own boards. We were put together for Sadiq Khan's mayoral term in March, and we are writing the food strategy for London. It's going to be published in January 2018.
But I was listening to you earlier. That is a huge animal in terms of the areas you're looking at. You're looking at everything from equality of access to food, diversity of access to food, food for young people and old people. There's so much to it, isn't there?
Absolutely right. There is so much to it. That is the biggest challenge of the food board. How do you take a subject like food and try and create meaningful policy around it? There are 14 very experienced people on the food board, essentially hand-picked from each of those areas. Everybody has an agenda, everybody wants to make a difference. The challenge for the strategy is how do you put that all together in a meaningful way?
I mean, because you talked also about, it's not food poverty, it's poverty actually, because it doesn't matter whether you can afford food or you can afford to clothe your kids or yourself. How can we reduce the cost of food and make it more accessible but healthier at the same time?
I can give you a personal answer to that question. For me, food poverty isn't poverty. Sorry, I'll start again. For me, food poverty is poverty. And the challenge really is around education. How can we take basic skills, start to teach people how to do different things with potatoes, carrots? Poverty is a huge issue in London, but where we can start to make impact is by teaching people what to do. For me, I'm a teacher, I'm an educator. I really believe that if we start to show people what to do, how to cook, we'll start to challenge a lot of these food poverty conversations.
I mean, you know, just looking at the Sikh community, one of their great pillars is the langar, and actually having food available free for anybody that visits the Gurdwara. So that is out there at the moment, and I think there is the ability to build on that, isn't there?
Absolutely, and that's what we need to celebrate more. We need to talk about London's diversity of food as well, and what is the definition of great cooking. So let's take what we do really well. Let's talk about that. Let's look at the areas which are big around poverty. How can we address those issues? And poverty, in my understanding, poverty for me is essentially lack of knowledge, expertise. Perhaps we've got two or three generations in a family who haven't cooked and they're very used to the ready meal or let's go out and buy pizza or chicken. Of course, that to me feels a much more expensive way to eat.
No, I agree, and I think it's about probably having more choices, or at least understanding or knowing that you have more choices, maybe.
Yes, and how do we engage and make it interesting? Because cooking is also looked at as a chore. When you have got so many other challenges in life, is cooking really high up on the agenda? Do we celebrate it enough? And I think one of the big areas within the food strategy is cooking in schools. We have, I can't remember his name, Tim from Charlton Manor School. He's a headmaster. He has a food governor. It's a great, great template for what every primary school should be doing, which is having a food ambassador. Let's talk about the story of food to our children and via the children to the parents. So they have cookery classes for the parents. They bring in all the different minority background people and look at what they're doing at home. Let's talk about dal. Let's talk about stews. Let's engage with food from the home.
No, fantastic. I think it's great work. And I do think there's some real benefits we can see coming through. So thank you so much for joining us. It's great to listen to you today as well. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the event.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to speak to you.
So, Andrea, I've had a fantastic afternoon learning about sustainability of food. But what I've also loved is talking about Italian passion for local produce and local dishes that you talked about earlier.
Yes, I think that is all about it. What we need to really concentrate on is the ingredients, the passion, the farmers, the supply chain, and also the citizen, as one of our guests mentioned, which is right. I don't like to call them customers. We are all stakeholders in the same world. We have to create a community. and deliver good food and deliver good chance for the farmers to grow their own food.
So it's 1 year of Mercato Metropolitano, and that embodies that feeling, doesn't it?
It is, absolutely. It embodies completely the feeling of 1 year of achievement. We came here and there was this abandoned space here, this old factory. It was beautiful, actually. And in 1 year, we turned it into probably one of the most, popular places in Elephant and Castle. We gather more than 1.5 million people in only 1 year without a single pound spent in advertising, because we believe that food is talked about and it's all word of mouth.
And I love the fact that this is about enjoying food together. You've got open spaces, you've got open seating. It's, you know, there's a vast variety of different food products here, but it's about enjoying it together.
The four main concepts of Mercato are eat, buy, learn, and share. Because if you don't share, even the Mediterranean famous food culture means nothing. You have to eat with someone and share your food with passion with someone. That's why we have so many tables around here.
So a year ago, you stood here on this site, probably thinking, what have I done? Yes. It's open today. Do you think you'd be stood here a year later and it to be such a success? And so such different produce in there as well.
You never know if it's going to be a success. I've been doing this for 25 years and it's always a question mark. When you start thinking, oh, it's going to be a success, you're dead. You always have to be careful because every place is different, even within London. It depends on where you go. But for sure, what we are transmitting is a kind of ethos and atmosphere, which honestly, we've found the same response from Tokyo to Milano to Boston to other places. It means that there is something which is really uniting us all, which is the sense of community, being together, eating together, and understanding what food means for our society and for ourselves as persons. So I didn't know it would have been quite successful. It's not yet so successful. It's quite successful. But we put all our effort into it. So this is the most important thing.
I mean, what I remember most about really good food is the place where I experienced it, and actually the people that I experienced it with. And, you know, whether it's in the Dordogne and it's foie gras, or whether it's here in cheddar cheese, or whether it's in Italy and some of the most amazing food you have, I'll remember the place and the people first, and then maybe the food second.
It is always the case. And sometimes you drink a wine, which is a normal wine, but you are in the right place, with the right atmosphere, with the right people, and you remember it as the most amazing wine in your life. And maybe it was not. But again, that's why we need the socialization part. So when I was interviewed once and they asked me what is the secret of the Mediterranean diet, why do we live longer? I don't know if it's the case, but we hope so. Of course it's ingredients and all the wonderful products with the antioxidant. We have olive oil, etc. But I think this counts for 50%. The other 50% is sitting together with your family, with your friends, cooking together, enjoying together, preparing food together. This is the part which makes us live longer and happier.
I'm with you on that, and I've had a fantastic afternoon and evening. Thank you so much. I'd recommend to anybody to come down to Mercato Napoletano. It's fantastic and such a great atmosphere and a community feel. So well done. Well done on 1 year, and let's hope there's many, many more to come.
Thank you very much indeed, and we'll do our best to continue. Thank you so much.
Well, that was a great experience. We're apparently going to go in and enjoy the Ministry of Sound in a minute, although I'm probably far too old for that. What caught your eye this afternoon and evening?
The panel was quite informative, talking about sustainability of food. The best fact I found was London will run out of food in 3 days if all the supply was cut off. So it's quite scary to think about, and it's something we all need to think about. So that's been what's hit me the hardest.
I loved hearing about the food they're actually producing from free waste product that would have been lost and just, you know, rotted away. And actually there's some great work going on, and we need to push supermarkets more to say, look, you're warping the market, and actually it needs to stop. Local produce, locally produced, communities coming together, I think, so is what it's all about.
Yeah, a third of all food going to waste, it's not good enough. And as populations continue to grow, the importance of using this food wisely is increasing. Events like this are going to help raise awareness and educate people, which is what's needed.
Great, James. Thanks for joining me today. It's been really great. And I hope people have enjoyed the interviews.
Brilliant. Thanks, Steve.
There we go. That's Disco Soup. All interesting stuff. So we're back in the studio. I'm feeling a little bit less depressed now because I've topped up on some chocolate. But it's a really important thing. And Sean, I think we should probably lobby a bit more for this plastic free aisle. If anybody listening wants to join in your campaign, where should they go?
If they just go to aplasticplanet.com. And they can just send in a little 7-second video. All the instructions are there.
Yeah.
And then share, you know, all of those things. The more support we have, the better, because this is the kind of movement where it's going to come from the people. If we want to see change, let's prove to the supermarkets and the big business that we want it.
Yeah, and also with things like, do you remember the tuna thing when dolphins were getting caught in all these nets? Mm. And the public did get behind that. And that happened very quickly, where the supermarkets banned all that stuff, didn't they? And went for line-caught tuna in quite a quick way, didn't they? Because people just stopped buying it literally overnight. I don't think it's going to be quite that easy for you, by the way, Sean. But it can be done.
I think it can. I feel we really are at that tipping point of it isn't cool to walk down the street holding a plastic bottle of water anymore. Mm.
Did you hear that, Guy? There you go.
I do now.
Yeah. Okay, Adam, let's come to you. So it's Adam Beveridge of Hollabox, and Hollabox is spelt H-O-L-L-A box, hollabox.com. And this is an app that puts the local world in your pocket. And you can go and actually look around a restaurant, can't you? Do you want to explain it a bit better than I just have?
No worries. So Hollabox is all about, as you say, being able to put the local world in your pocket, being able to actually, with your own eyes, step inside any bar, restaurant or kind of hotspot in your city and kind of get a better sense of an atmosphere and the specials and kind of what it's offering, more so than any kind of, you know, staged marketing picture or any, you know, promoted video can do.
So if I normally go onto a restaurant webpage, I'll get a menu up there, and I might get some, you know, sort of artistically shot photographs, and that pretty much is the only thing I can gauge in terms of the atmosphere,
well,
isn't it? I might get a map, can read some TripAdvisor stuff, but I don't get a feel for what it's like when I go in.
Exactly. So that's exactly what we're trying to overcome here. So yeah, as you said, you go into a restaurant, you see a great picture, and it's like, oh, cool. So you've got tables and chairs. Well, that's a great start, you know. But people buy into people. People, you know, our time is precious, and people want to make the most of their experiences. So that's what we're about, showing the actual experience you can have, the actual atmosphere you're going to get, not just the kind of space you're going to be sitting in, if you know what I mean. So.
And I think that's a key word that you've used there, experience, especially because you're a young chap and you're clearly targeting the younger market as well. And they're much more about the experience than they are about the actual food that they're eating or the things that they're drinking.
Completely, yeah. In this day and age, you know, with house prices being a joke and people really valuing their time. Young people particularly need an authority and someone they can trust, and they don't have a lot of money to kind of spend on these things. So going to places and doing things that are, you know, a good spend of their time, a good, you know, spending their time properly. And they need this kind of app, this kind of service that we're providing, this actual insight.
So what you're saying then, Adam, is if I'm a bit limited on my funds and I'm going to go out with my friends on a Friday, I'm absolutely really, really want to know that when I turn up, we are going to have a good time.
Exactly.
It is going to be how it's, because I don't want to waste that money and go home on a Friday and think, oh, actually, that wasn't quite what I expected. Right. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly the point. And this is all kind of rooted from our days at university. You know, I'm of the opinion that life's too short, right? So we need to make the most of our time here. And as I said, with young people, money is precious, time is precious. And numerous times I would look at, you know, a TripAdvisor review or a staged marketing picture, for example, and then I'd go to the place and the experience would either be 10 times worse than it was advertised to me or 1,000 times better. And I think, well, it's a bit of a waste of my time when I'm making that decision to go to a place. So this is what it's about. It's about improving that decision-making process for an individual.
So we go onto your website, which is hollabox.com, and I see there's loads of videos up there. And how are you monetizing it? Is it the restaurants and cafes themselves are saying, can you come and do this quick Snapchat type thing and we'll pay you? Or how's it working?
So we're actually an app first. So obviously, when young people being out and about and going, oh, what do we want to do now? What do we want to do later in the day? Obviously, using an app and using phone first is the kind of way we're going forward. we have various monetization strategies. So yeah, a lot of businesses do come to us and say, oh, I really like what you're doing, because it's video first, because of that, how much more engaging that is to our users. Businesses do come to us and say, oh, I want to be featured. I want you to come in and film. And we film everything on smartphones. We film everything with 4K smartphones. So businesses still get the good quality they expect from like a professional shoot. But it's that got that user-generated feel, much like Snapchat. So TripAdvisor is really successful because people trust them, because it's user-generated. Snapchat,
supposedly.
Supposedly.
I think it's always user generated, but yeah.
So when you watch like a Snapchat video, we're obviously familiar with Snapchat.
Or an Instagram story type thing. Yeah. Similar form factor, aren't they?
You forgive the poor quality of it because it's from your friends most of the time. With a service like ours, it needs to be informative because obviously you're being convinced to go there. The business is selling you something.
Yeah.
So we think we've hit quite a really nice and innovative formula here of a mix of good quality footage with a very modern Snapchat user experience and user interface. And yeah, businesses can pay us to be on the app. Larger brands can come to us and we can implement geofenced advertising. So this is the ability for brands, or when a user's near a brand or a place, that kind of content comes up on our app. And sort of other experiences, as I said, with the video itself. So you can actually have full-length video advertising, which again is much more engaging and very, very in vogue at the moment in the market for advertisers.
It takes over the whole screen, doesn't it? So
exactly.
You're immersed in an advert. You're not distracted by some other thing that's flashing up on the screen. You're there and you're, you know, watching the whole thing.
Exactly. And it's not quite as sort of nasty as those banner ads or intrusive ads that you get on most ads.
You want to scream.
A lot of tech in our day now can use sort of like AI, machine learning stuff to actually give you the ads and the things that are relevant to you and personal to you. Mm. And that's one of the key things of having a good tech and good back end to our app and what we're doing.
And Sean, you've deliberately used video as well. I mean, this is the medium really to get your messages across.
Yeah.
And you were saying you're getting people not to write to their MP or stuff like that, but people used to.
Yeah.
But you're saying, please just shoot me a quick video. And
do a quick selfie video saying, you know, my name is Sue and I'm a plastic addict, but I'm ready for change and I want a plastic-free aisle, and that's it.
Mm.
And then they quickly upload that and then they're part of it. And people want to be part of movements now, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Do they?
Yes. Well,
movement averse.
Yeah, you're movement free.
It's because you've got all this free time now. You can just leisurely stroll around.
I've got all this free time. I just said I'm less busy than I used to be because, you know, when your children leave home, you have got a bit. I mean, maybe I'm a sort of, into movements more, I think. I think I feel more passionate as I'm getting older. I'm getting crosser about things, more angry about things.
Opinionated.
There you go.
I mean,
what you're doing
Victor
now,
Victor Meldrew, you know, as I'm turning older, like moaning all the time.
Well, is that wrong with Victor?
Is that Meldrew? What you're meaning? Is that you just like whinge more as you get older? Yeah, I'll do that.
Well,
if
that's
a movement.
We get on so well because we just sit and moan about all sorts of stuff on the radio.
Yeah, I just think I am quite cross about things, and I'm very proud of people of your generation. Sorry, that sounded terribly condescending, Adam, but because I do think you're much more passionate than we are, and I do think you care more. And I know it's a generalisation, don't you, Sean? I'm very proud of this generation. I'm holding out lots of good hopes that our generation have cocked up quite a lot, and this lot are going to come around and sweep it up. And that's what I'm hoping.
I think you're right, Sue, because I think their value measurements are different.
Yeah.
And you know, for us, probably. We're about the same age, and it was all the Thatcher generation, and it was all about getting your foot on the property ladder and you're getting into a career, and then everything will fall into place. And it's so interesting for me. I have two sons who are 23 and 24, completely different, so differently motivated, particularly my 23-year-old, who it is all about experiences. And he's not going to rush into getting involved in the material things that we care about so much. That we are a massive consumer generation. And the next one is going to be less about things.
But I think that for me is because we didn't have anything when we were younger, and therefore having those things was suddenly amazing because we didn't have anything. You know, when I was a kid, we had outside toilet, and that's hilarious now. No bathroom, you know, nobody has that now, hopefully.
I think
we didn't have stuff, and so therefore you wanted it, whereas these guys have been brought up with stuff everywhere,
stuff,
and therefore it doesn't have the value that it has.
Yeah, so
maybe.
The rebellion against this overstuffification that we have now is, let's have less stuff.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think it's more the power of the apps like Facebook and these social networking apps where you can kind of see what your friends are doing. You can see the experiences you're kind of missing out on. So it's not necessarily about just, what materialistic things are going to have. It's oh, what am I missing out and what can I go and do
so,
with my time?
So we had material envy, you lot have got experience envy.
I think there's a lot of expectation and it's a very competitive kind of world, a lot more so than I would say of your generation perhaps. So I think it's there's a lot more expected of us as we're going out. So I think we're of this mindset where, oh God, I've got to achieve, I've got to make the most of my life because it's short and I don't want to get to like 50, 60 and just think, oh, what have I done with my life? So it's a real pressure at a young age to think, right, I've got to make the right choices now and do the right things now. I mean, that might just be my opinion, but from people I work with and other young people going through university, this is the kind of environment I think we're growing up in now.
And I think because of all the social networking and everybody is interconnected, you can see what everybody else is doing and people can see what you're doing
That appalls me.
Yeah, and I don't like it personally.
There's a downside to it, isn't
there? I struggle with FOMO. Doing all that kind of thing. But I think that is maybe one of the reasons why these campaigns and this kind of experiential stuff is really catching on, because people are like, oh, I want to be seen to be doing cool stuff, or this is something that I believe in, or this says a lot about me as a person, and you blast it out across social media and people can, learn about you that kind of way. It's interesting. Yeah.
It can be over curated though, can't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's where it becomes a bit dangerous, because people aren't, it's not a true reflection of their lives.
No, exactly.
But a lot of people are watching it and actually all it does is make them feel bad.
It can go both ways.
I'm not inviting you again on the radio programme. Every time you do stuff, Sean, I just get more depressed. You just made me more depressed again.
That's so funny, because whereas people think of me as Miss Optimistic. All right.
So, oh God.
It's the chocolate. Honestly, I had a little buzz and now
it's gone.
Now we're crashing.
Well, you won't believe it, but it's the end of the show yet again. Sorry.
Time just flies, doesn't it?
Time just flies. I think it's very important that if anybody is interested in the plastic debate, and I certainly learned a lot today, and I think, yes, please go and join the campaign. Just remind me of the website again, please, Sean.
So it's aplasticplanet.com.
Have a look
Get
at
involved.
That. Why don't we all just say, I don't want a plastic, thanks very much. And your stuff is really good, and I hope, Adam, that it's going to go from strength to strength. It's great on the website. I've had a really good look.
Yeah, the app is fantastic. So app is it's great. Got a really nice form factor to it.
Yeah,
Thank you.
It
yeah, is. Everyone can check it out on the App Store. Any restaurants, anyone listening, feel free to get in touch. We do curate our restaurants that we pick, but we're always willing to listen to new people and see what you're about.
Brilliant.
Good man.
And that's holobox.com.
Holobox.com or at the Holobox on the App Store.
Yeah, go on the App Store. That's the easiest way. So you've been listening to the Food Talk show, and we're now syndicated all over the place. So even if you're listening to our show in California or Michigan and Malta, all the other places, you can still do the plastic thing. Help us. And thank you to my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge of Food Rush. And if you want to recommend any future guests, if you want to just, make
hello.
A comment,
Yeah,
go on to Twitter. We're on @FoodTalkShow. Or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, you can go to foodtalk.co.uk. Thank you to our guests. Have a good week. Bye.